I'd like now to welcome to the program Cherie Burns. She's author of the book Searching for Beauty, The Life of Millicent Rogers, the American Heiress Who Taught the World About Style. And she will be at Garcia Street Books this Sunday, the 16th of December at 2 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So Millicent Rogers, we know from Taos, and we'll talk about Taos in a few moments, but she was basically, as you say in the title, an heiress. She was born into a wealthy family. She lived the life of luxury, although she was also combating illnesses her whole life. But for the half century that she was alive, she was on the very top of the aristocratic world, so to speak. How did you decide to write her biography, and what is it about her that made you want to really explore her life?
Well, I discovered her, as I think many people do, in Taos at the Millicent Rogers Museum. And as I looked at that photo of her on the wall, I thought, who is this woman and why don't I know more about her? Of course, I knew about Mabel Dodge Luhan and Dorothy Brett and Frieda Lawrence. And the more I considered writing about Millicent and I looked into her story, I saw that, first off, her life expanded very much beyond Taos, but she had lived a life that was somewhat emblematic, a representative of what was going on in this country in the first half of the 20th century. She was the product of the robber barons and great tycoons amassing that great wealth. She was a flapper. She was a debutante. She was like an Edith Wharton's heroine that she married impoverished nobility and had that breakaway, a little bit of a wild girl thing. Then she lived that really heady, high-living expatriate life that many Americans did in Europe. She came back during the war effort, worked in the war effort. When the war ended, where did the face of American glamour go? Hollywood. So, of course, Millicent had an affair with Clark Gable and also went to Hollywood. And it was really at the end of that period that she did the one thing that wasn't reflected. She came to Taos. And it was circumstantial. Her heart had been broken by Gable. She had friends that brought her here. But then I think she really, there was real change in her life. She really reset a lot about herself. She was a mistress at reinventing herself, that's for certain.
A mistress at reinventing herself?
Yes.
Like as opposed to a master?
Well, except that she's a woman, I say mistress, but she, each of those decades she reinvented herself. I think a lot of women with her money and opportunities might have gotten into a niche and stayed there, but it was the fact that Millicent was restless. She always looked around and she had the wherewithal and the resources to remake herself wherever she went.
It is such a story about the constraints that wealth put on you. I couldn't help but wondering as I was thinking about her what her life would have been like if she'd been a regular middle-class lady who'd had to, or working-class lady who'd had to, you know, fight and survive and make something of herself and work for a living and things like that, because obviously she had some spirit, but there's a way in which having that kind of, being in that kind of society really constrains what your choices are.
Well, I think it also prevented her from achieving the height that she might have creatively. I mean, even in the fashion world, and this is my own bent, but this is really a full biography. It's nice that her imprint on fashion has been remembered for so long, but that was really just one piece of her story. She was creative, and I think had she not had money, she may well have succeeded in design, in fashion, in things
that
she did anyhow.
Yeah.
So in a way, you can say that the money handicapped her reaching her full potential in a way. I mean, you can't play God and say that, but it certainly helped on some fronts and didn't help in other ways. I think, you know, so a lot of people have a lot of money and buy a lot of clothes and are good looking like Millicent was, but you still don't think of them for their imprint and their style and that they are creative and make a difference. And I think that she could have done that without her money.
So she spent her life and certainly had, and this is also a funny thing, you think about these women throughout history, and particularly in the 20th century, we seem to know a lot about women who had affairs, like romantic love situations with very famous and well-known men, and that was almost their claim to fame, whereas the men actually accomplished things in their own right. But then she came to Taos, and as you say, it was a real turning point for her. What did that look like?
Well, I want to go back just a second and say one of the things that you learn a few things about a book even after you're finished with it, or about your subject and you're talking about it. I have come to think that men were important to Millicent, but they were not the center of her life. Her life did not change and revolve around the men she married. They were almost, accessories is too light a word, but they were second to what she was doing. When she arrived in Taos, there were a couple of things going on. She was unquestionably a great aesthete, and she loved beauty, and she was at a time in her life where I think she reset her gauge for beauty from fine fabrics, fine jewels, to all the things that New Mexico and Taos has to offer: starry nights, rustic elements in houses and in clothing designs. She, like many, many well-to-do Anglo women that came out here, she was captivated by the idea of the noble savage, and they loved the American Indians, and she both loved them as a people and also had an Indian lover. And I think if there's anything new in this book, instead of it just telling this complete story, it's really that Millicent had very strong feelings for Mabel Dodge Lewin's husband, Tony Lujan.
Right.
And I don't think she acted out on them. She acted out on a lot of things in her life, but he certainly became the epitome of her idea of what manhood should be and a great person. But taking a breath for a moment, I think that because she was not well, she had had rheumatic fever her whole life, she was often fighting it, going to bed for weeks at a time, that there was also this sense of coming to peace with life and her creator and the things that you feel in a place like Taos, in the mountains, in a life that's scaled down to basic elements. And I think that was extraordinarily important to her then. Big change.
Now, when you think about Taos suddenly having two major female heiresses at the same time, Mabel Dodge Lujan and Millicent Rogers, and one of them was interested in the other one's husband, it was basically a setup for them not to get along.
Well, that setup was there a little bit anyhow. One of the things that I think is forgotten is Mabel was close to 20 years older than Millicent. So she was in some ways a woman of a different generation. And I don't think Millicent came here to be the doyenne of town the way that Mabel had. Millicent came here to enjoy herself, to indulge herself in her house, to explore the Indian culture, to collect things. She always came and enjoyed collecting things. So I think some of the... People talked about knowing there was tension up there in Taos between these two women. I think it was easy for Mabel to resent her. She was both rich, far better looking, younger, and she was moving in on her relationship with an attraction for the Indians. But I don't think it was quite as pitched as people think. Millicent also kept herself a lot.
And so what was her life like here? She was here for a period of 6 years?
6 years. Well, first off, she did come and go, and the first part of that, she was very engaged with getting her house set up. She'd bought an old hacienda that she needed to restore, but she loved going out to the reservations and the Indian lands. She spent a lot of time, she both liked the pageantry, watching the dances, collecting things. She would go off 3 or 4 days at a time on a camping trip. That was terrific for her. Then she would have a period where she would plan a trip. Sometimes she would have to postpone it, as she did one famous trip in the book where she took Dorothy Brett and a number of Indians and her cook from Virginia, a black woman, and they all went across the country. And that was quite something, going across the South with all those mixed races and things. But she would have to rest up before she started on these trips because, again, she was always subject to a weak heart and becoming ill. So I think that also began to focus her in looking at the meaning of life and looking at the native elements around her. By that I mean natural elements. She had fun here. It was a simpler, more humble life. She had girlfriends. She ate dinner in the kitchen at Frieda Lawrence and with Dorothy Brett. These were things that, as in her life as a rich socialite, had not been quite as easy to achieve. And I think that that was part of the appeal to her of life at that time.
Now, how did the museum come into being?
The museum came into being because when she died, right after New Year's in 1953, again, she had always been such a collector. She had so many baskets, so many pieces of Indian jewelry. She was actually trying to popularize that on a more national awareness of this wonderful work that the Indians did, when the lawyer came out with her three sons and Millicent's mother, who outlived Millicent, he said, "What are we going to do with all this junk?" And that was really the seminal point for the museum, because the Millicent's mother and her sons created a foundation. They had a museum on Ladue Street there in Taos in the beginning. It was more of a foundation with a few things, and over the years it expanded to be the wonderful Millicent Rogers Museum now in the north of town.
It's an interesting story because, I mean, a lot of people, they write biographies of people who did amazing things and Martin Luther King or whatever, and this is in a way a kind of smaller story of a woman who is, you know, she'd made a mark in New Mexico, which is positive for us who come behind her, but there's other things that her story can tell us. One of them is that she's a person who was continually for her whole life dealing with illness and with her own mortality.
Well, that impressed me in the reporting because there were so many letters that she wrote when she was sick, and never once did I read of her feeling sorry for herself. That much intrigued me. She seemed, and I didn't feel that she was doing it because she thought someone else was going to read them and that would be an unbecoming position for her. I just think that she had lived with that her whole life. She made the most of it. That was when she created jewelry. That was when she wrote letters. That was when she read books. She studied languages. She spent that time very wisely. But I do think anyone that had been as sick as she had been, she had rheumatic fever when she was 8 years old, was not expected to live to be 10, and was dealing with her heart problems. These were the days before penicillin. That she knew that her life could end at any time. And I think that that did direct the way that she lived. And I think by the time she got to Taos, that sense of her own mortality was much more in the front of her thinking. And when you read the letters that she wrote to her son Paul as she was shuttling back and forth between her doctors in Santa Fe, the most famous one where she talks about being part of the earth and that he should not grieve for her when she dies, you see that this woman made quite a progression. You know, from the 24-year-old that ran into Hickson's in New York City and demanded to speak only French, and then talking about her own death.
I know. I mean, she's an American. She goes into a store. She won't deal with anybody who doesn't speak French, even though she's an American shopping in the United States. And you just think, this is an insufferable snob of the highest order.
But you also have to hand it to her a little bit, because most women buckled under and did what they were told. And even ones with money. And Millicent always had someone trying to tell her what to do. Her father basically broke up her first marriage. She was pretty indomitable. She managed to work her way around it. You know, she wasn't a great activist or radical, but she did follow her own star.
And she had three children over the course of her life, and she left this museum behind. She also, speaking of mortality, converted to Catholicism shortly before her death.
She did.
Why did she do that?
Well, it seems, if in speaking with her living son, it seems that she was somewhat hedging her bets at this point. But she lived in a culture where I think that Catholicism was around. Goodness knows she'd been married to two men previously that had been Catholics. She really, however, I think that while she did that, remember, the Catholic Church was certainly active at the Pueblo at that time, and she loved all things that the Indians did and out at the Pueblo, but she had developed in many ways sort of her own faith and religion at that point. Her letters reflect a real kind of spiritualism, a feeling that she had about Taos Mountain, feeling that she had about the Indians and their appreciation for nature and their God. So I think it was a rather eclectic religious outlook, but she did allow herself and sought to be baptized.
And for those who read the book, if you're really into style and beauty and glamour and things like that, one craves more pictures. There's some pictures in the book, but there's a lot more of her kind of glamour that we would love to see.
Well, there are lots of wonderful images of her, and for the author, the problem, of course, is the cost of licensing photos, because she was photographed by every fabulous photographer that was shooting for Harper's Bazaar and Vogue at that time. I have to confess, when I began the book, though I realized she had created something of an impression in the world of fashion, I didn't know enough about fashion in the beginning or understand the role that she played in it. And she really was quite significant in it. She had that ability to mix the rustic and the refined, and she had done that wherever she went, whether it was Switzerland or whether it was here wearing the broomstick skirts and mixing that up with her couturier. And she cast a very long shadow in the world of fashion. In fact, I think over the years, as she reinvented herself and moved around the world and the country, it was the fashion world that kept an eye on her and remembered her the most. And that's been gratifying for the book. But you have to remember, now we dress the way that we want and anything goes. But in her day, fashion was much more prescribed, and she was really quite a trendsetter and considered quite a maverick. And she also had taste. Not everybody with that kind of money had taste.
Right.
She made a real impression.
How has the writing of this book affected you? How has it changed your outlook in any way?
Well, it was wonderful for me to begin this book when I started living here full-time, because I had to learn a lot about New Mexico, and it was a perfect, this is my third book, it was a perfect blend of living somewhere and working on the story from here. Although I say that, I traveled a lot to the places where Millicent had lived and the family archives and papers. She, Washington, D.C., New York, Fairhaven, Massachusetts, L.A., she really moved around. I'm not certain that I'm going to do a biography next. I always write and work for the same reason. I like writing about people, and it doesn't always have to be in a biography. It just so happened I was so lucky, because Millicent was so interesting. Working 5 years on one person, I had never spent that much time. And she was just, there's no other way to say it, but interesting, changing her life all the time. And there was also a lot to learn about the places that she was in. I didn't know that much about wartime Washington, the war effort, and what was going on there. I didn't know that much about the fashion world. So it was a great learning experience. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do next, but I'm not confining myself to biography. And I hope that it will be something that I learn as much about as I did with her. It's always interesting writing about people. And no matter how much has been said about them, and they're everything about her was generally in old newspaper articles, because there wasn't a primary text. This was the first biography of her. I like to report. I like to talk to people who can fill you in on that little detail and augment what's there by the academics or there in the newspapers with live reporting. So that's what drives me. I'm not real certain what I'm going to do next.
Cherie Burns is author of Searching for Beauty, The Life of Millicent Rogers, the American Heiress Who Taught the World About Style. And once again, she will be at Garcia Street Books on Sunday, September 16th at 2 in the afternoon. You can find out more at garciastreetbooks.com. And you can find out more also at CherieBurns.com. And Cherie is spelled C-H-E-R-I-E. We'll link to it on our website. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'm happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Katie Della Maggiore. She is director and producer of the documentary Brooklyn Castle, which opens this Friday at the CCA Cinematheque here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you.
So this is a fascinating, I just love this documentary. It's about a Brooklyn public junior high school, IS 318, which basically produces the nation's best chess players. What is going on there?
Yeah, I mean, that was the question that I had when I found out that fact as well. You know, I had read an article in the New York Times about a talented young chess player who went to a high school in Brooklyn that I was familiar with. And at first I thought that that might be an interesting angle for a documentary. But I did some digging and actually found out that there was a junior high school that actually had won more national chess championships than any other school in the nation, and they were still a little under the radar, unlike this high school that had been written up about, had been written up in the newspaper. And so it kind of seemed like an undiscovered story that was worth telling. And so I went to check out the junior high school one day before work. I was kind of just working a day job at the time as a TV producer. And I went there one day before work, and what I found immediately was a culture of success at the school that was kind of on immediate display when you walk into the school. So, like, as soon as you walk in, there's trophies, hundreds of trophies and banners, like, covering the hallways, celebrating the success of this chess team, which, you know, is kind of unexpected. Usually when you walk into a school, especially a middle school, you know, you expect to see the sports teams but not necessarily the chess team. And so I think that partly has a lot to do with it, the fact that the school really does support the chess program and really does celebrate it. And obviously beyond that, you know, there would be no chess program without the two dedicated teachers, the teacher and the assistant principal that are featured in the movie. And so there's the chess teacher, Elizabeth Vickery. She's really the brains behind the operation, and she's the one who really can, you know, take the kids and inspire them to want to learn chess, and not only learn chess, but then actually become really good at it. And then John Galvin, the assistant principal, handles kind of all the administration, all the administrative kind of tasks that, you know, keep this chess program alive. And obviously that's in the midst of really bad budget cuts at the school. So he's has a big challenge throughout the film of kind of trying to figure out a way to keep this program funded, even as more money is cut from it. So, you know, I think that, like, you know, there is no secret recipe of what makes this team so special, but I think it's obviously a combination of what's needed at all schools, or, you know, what all after-school programs need, which is support from the administration and really dedicated and passionate instructors. And I think with those two things, you know, you can probably take any kind of program like chess and have it be as special as the one at 318.
So I love this, how in this school, IS 318, I mean, you think about the sort of American cliche of the junior high schools and high schools where the jocks are respected. In this school, it seems like the chess players are the rock stars of the school.
Yes, they are. Yeah, I mean, the chess team at 318 definitely shatters some stereotypes of what you expect chess players or young chess players to be like. I mean, I think there are definitely stereotypes out there about chess, you know, that the chess team is often nerdy, antisocial, you know, that they're kind of a weird, quirky bunch. And, you know, certainly that exists. Why not? But at 318, you know, I mean, I think there's such a diverse group of kids that play chess that there's lots of kids on the chess team, like Pobo, who's one of the stars of our film, who is, like, one of the most charismatic, outgoing, kind of popular kids you'll meet. And, you know, I think that's great that you can see that, you know, that a game like chess that might be seen as kind of like a nerdy sport when you're 10 or 11 years old, in fact, our movie kind of shows people that it's not, you know what I mean? That, like, any kind of kid can play chess. And, you know, there really aren't any, that all the stereotypes that you think are associated with it are actually shattered at 318 and in the movie.
Totally. And one of them is this, I mean, there's so many extraordinary people in the film, but one of them is this 13-year-old, at least when the film starts, African-American girl who is on track to become the first African-American female chess master. And all the stereotypes that we have about chess being a guy thing or being a white or now an Asian thing, I mean, this movie just busts them all.
Yeah, I mean, we were so excited to meet Rochelle when we first started shooting, and she told us that she was on track to potentially become a master. And if she became master, she would be the first female African-American woman to become a chess master. And so we were like, wow, what an amazing goal. You know what I mean? To be the first at anything is pretty awesome. And so You know, yeah, just that right there. I mean, being a woman, being a black woman, at her age, you know, all of these things, like you said, that people don't associate with chess for whatever reason. And it was so nice to be able to show people, you know, that for chess, you know, it's funny, like the game of chess really just comes down to like your brain and your opponent's brain. And it's one of those sports where everything else is kind of can be left off the board. It doesn't matter where you're from or how much money you have, how old you are, what sex you are. You know, if you can outsmart your opponent, then you could win. And so I think that's kind of a really wonderful lesson for people to learn, you know, in watching the film.
Now, is chess sex segregated?
Mm-mm. No, all the kids play together. So, you know, when they travel in tournaments, when they travel to compete in tournaments, all of the girls and all of the guys compete against each other. Although, you know, there are some special tournaments that are like for girls only, you know, but for the main tournaments, it's all mixed. But, you know, like for certain sports, you know, like say like golf or other sports, you know, you can compete in like a girls only event. And so there are some of those that Rochelle competes in, but she beats all the boys. I mean, when she's number one at her school, because she's beaten all of the boys in her class, and most of the chess team is made up of boys.
Now, let's talk about who these kids are and what their families are like. It seems like there's a lot of children of immigrants who are chess players in this school.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just kind of comes with the territory of the neighborhood that we shot in. You know, the neighborhood is made up of a lot of immigrant families, and the school itself is predominantly made up of Hispanic, African-American, Asian families. And so it's no surprise that the chess team is a pretty mixed bunch. I think that John Galvin, the assistant principal, told me once that like something like 20 different ethnicities were represented on the chess team at a certain given time. He called it like the UN of chess, like his chess team. So one of the kids in our film, Alexis, his family is from Paraguay, and, you know, they came to America, as he said, you know, in search of the American dream and really wanting to just have a better life for him. And, you know, you see in the film about how he uses chess or sees chess kind of as another way to further his life goals. You know, it's just like one more way that he can do better in school and ultimately get into a good college, get a good job, and kind of become, you know, the young man that he knows he can become and that he'd like to become to make his parents proud.
It's really a beautiful thing to watch, and it's sort of, I was watching it and thinking, people who are making noise about being anti-immigrant, whatever that even means, really should watch this movie.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, until you go into someone's home, it's really easy to judge, right? Until you can go into someone's home and actually see what's going on there. And I think that's, like, the wonderful thing about documentaries in general is it kind of, like, peels back the veil a little bit. And, you know, it's really easy to just kind of make broad stroke judgments about people sometimes. But then until you're actually, like, inside their home and seeing, it, for example, in the example of Alexis, like, how hard his family works and how hard he's working, you know, who would not want him to have access to every opportunity, you know, as a son of an immigrant? Who could watch this film and say, no, Alexis doesn't deserve to have every opportunity that's available to him? And that's kind of what we're hoping people think when they see the film.
Well, and also, who could watch this film and not realize that these people are the movers, shakers, and leaders of the next generation?
Well, exactly. Yeah, that someone like Alexis and Pobo, whose Pobo's parents are from Nigeria, you know, Pobo is going to do great things one day. And, yeah, I mean, I witnessed that going, you know, and meeting the families, you know, going into neighborhoods that people might write off or, you know, obviously with all the talk now about entitlements, right, and how much should we be contributing to schools, how much should we be contributing to families out of tax dollars, and then you kind of see programs like that at work, whether it be in schools or, you know, in public housing, and you kind of see, like, kids that are thriving, and you think, you know, these are the kids that are going to be our future. And if you keep taking away from them, then how do you, can you expect them to succeed? You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
These kids are under a lot of pressure. I mean, talk about the pressure of being a competitive chess player.
Yeah, I mean, the kids are under pressure, but I have to say that a lot of the pressure is just kind of internal pressure that they put on themselves. You know, I mean, obviously, it's an intense sport like any other. And so, and the kids want to win. I mean, they want to win because they're good. And when you become the kind of the best, you want to stay there. And so I think it's a good amount of pressure that they're under, because a lot of it comes from inside. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily pressure that's put on them from their parents or their coaches or teachers. I mean, certainly the coaches and teachers want the team to win, but, you know, you see in the film how Elizabeth Vickery, the teacher, she says time and time again that, you know, the lesson is not from winning. You know, the biggest lessons often come from losing and then figuring out why you lost. And so it's not just like they're just pushing the kids to win and that's the point of the whole thing. The point is kind of the journey that they take on the chessboard and kind of how they become better thinkers by becoming good chess players. And if they and they happen to win because of that, all the better.
Right.
Yeah, it's not all about winning, though.
One of the things that it really points out is the utter and complete folly in cutting taxes and cutting money from school programs. Because when you watch this documentary, you think these are kids who are on a path to success. That path comes through their after-school activity, chess. You cut that out, and the harm that is done is uncountable.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, does it?
It really doesn't.
It seems like I said, you know, there is a lot of pressure in general. I think, you know, we hear all this, kids are constantly hearing about how, you know, students in the United States are behind and we're not reaching the goals we should be like other countries. And, you know, everyone wants to prepare kids for, you know, the 21st century. And then it's like, okay, well, we're not going to give you the tools that you need to do that. Because obviously the tools to do that aren't just reading and math. You know what I mean? It's not just standardized tests that make you a well-rounded, kind of successful, happy adult. The things that do that are often, you know, the experiences you have after 3 o'clock too. You know, it's the experiences
right.
of being part of a program, being part of a team, being able to explore kind of your interests and your passions, and, you know, having access to programs like that is really important. And, you know, especially for kids who don't necessarily have parents who can afford to send them to, you know, kind of some extracurricular activities outside of school. You know, I mean, if schools don't offer after school programs or community centers don't offer after school programs and the parents can't afford it, then like, what are the kids doing when they get home at 3 o'clock, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's really something that we started to feel really strongly about when we started making, you know, we didn't go into the film even expecting for that to be an issue because the school hadn't even gotten hit with their budget cut when we first started shooting. But once they did, it became really clear to us how important this issue was and that it was happening at schools all across the country, and that we really hope that the film can shine a light on that.
Very much so. And it also shines the light on the fact that while there's so much work that is offloaded onto individuals and onto parents that used to be taken care of by the school, like here in Santa Fe, you see all these lists of school supplies that parents are supposed to buy for their children, which used to be supplied by the school for their children, art supplies and things like that. And what you have now is you actually have taxation being offloaded onto parents and teachers and students in the form of making them fundraise for things that really should be part of the school curriculum, like being able to travel for chess tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, I firmly believe that, I mean, these programs are part of a full education. And when budgets are cut, or when people are looking at how to trim budgets, because obviously as the economy worsens, you know, as it has worsened over the years, you know, that all trickles down from the federal to the state level down to the school districts. And then, you know, people have budgets in front of them, well-meaning, you know, Department of Education officials, you know, have to cut their budgets. But where do they cut from? You know, they're looking at a line item and it's like, well, we can't cut reading, we can't cut math, you know, we can't cut more teachers. And so the first thing to go are the things that are seen as extras. And I think, I don't have a solution necessarily for fixing the economy at the moment, but I think that if you could at least start to not see these programs as extras, then perhaps they wouldn't be so easily cut, you know, when budgets are tight, that perhaps schools and districts could be a little bit more creative of how to keep these programs going, you know? And so that way the weight of it doesn't fall on the parents and the students to have to fundraise to keep the programs going.
Now, you did a great job filming the chess tournaments, which is basically a bunch of kids sitting around and staring at a board. It is not exactly high drama.
Exactly. Yeah, we knew going into this that we would have to figure out a way to make chess seem exciting, because like you said, from the outside, it you know, if you were to walk into a chess tournament, it would be a room of, you know, 1,000 kids sitting in silence, staring intently at each other. And you think, great, what's happening? Doesn't really make for, like, exciting movie making. But so we, you know, definitely decided that we would approach the chess play in as a dynamic way as possible. And, you know, my husband Nelson, who's the editor on the film and producer, and my brother Brian, who's the cinematographer and a producer on the film, they both have a fair amount of experience working in sports production and, like, baseball and football and basketball. And so we really wanted to kind of, like, treat the footage and treat the chess element in, like, the way you might see any other sport treated on TV, kind of with that same intensity. And I think that the way we did that was maybe not focusing on the X's and O's of how you play chess, because that's not something anyone's going to understand if they don't play chess, but really focusing on kind of like the emotions of it, because I think that that's what really everybody can relate to, kind of the, you know, the sweat on the eyebrow and the tapping foot and, you know, the tears afterwards or the celebration afterwards, you know, kind of those emotional ups and downs that come with really any competitive sport.
Right, right. There's no slow motion of the great move or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, but no one's going to care why, you know, the king moved to C4. Like, none of that stuff we thought would matter, or I mean, it really wouldn't matter to anybody. But with some really fantastic music, you know, we're also able to at least make the chess play that we do show, along with, like I said, kind of the emotional reactions of the kids, where you can really feel like you were watching something happen. Even if you didn't know what was happening, we wanted people to kind of feel like, for that quick moment, that they were right there kind of on the board with Alexis, like as he was thinking about what to do next.
Now, do we know what happens to kids who are chess champions in junior high and high school? Do we know what happens to them to like 10, 15 years later?
You mean like personally or like in school or?
Well, like what? So you've got kids who 10, 15 years ago were champion chess players. What do they do with their lives?
I mean, I don't know. That's a good question. There's not a whole lot of opportunity out there to become a professional chess player. You know, it's just not really a career. I mean, there are definitely people who do that, but I think the majority of people who play chess don't become professional chess players.
No.
And John Galvin, you know, and Elizabeth Vickery say that, you know, that that's not the goal of the program at 318, is to turn the kids into professional chess players. And so I think the majority of people don't, but they continue playing chess throughout their lives and hopefully find some way to parlay that chess success into success in their professional life, you know, which I think definitely does happen.
Well, that's what I was wondering. I mean, if you have that kind of mastery of focus and strategy and kind of long-term thinking, I would think that would be able to translate itself into all kinds of other professions, whether it be law or business or medicine or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the stats on it, but I mean, I've definitely read and have been told like lots of anecdotal stories of, you know, CEOs of major corporations that play chess, you know, very successful people on Wall Street. You know, I mean, there's always like these stories. You kind of hear sometimes people come out of the chess closet and you find out that some of like the most successful people are actually, you know, at chess players, you know, like a Bill Gates or something like that.
Right.
So I think there definitely are a lot of parallels. You know, you don't have to be a genius to play chess, and not every chess player is a brilliant business person or a brilliant artist, but certainly I think that for the kids that work hard, that play chess, for whatever it is that they want to do in life, the chess will help that. You know, it will help them do that. Now, I mean, the chess isn't going to turn someone who's not motivated all of a sudden into a motivated person. But, you know, for the kids that, you know, have a goal and something that they want to do in their life, with like a lot of the kids in the film do, the chess is just kind of like a great motor to kind of keep that going, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. What are your hopes for this film in terms of what kind of dialogue it can create?
Well, I think, you know, you brought up a lot of it already so far. I think that, you know, the dialogue that we wanted to create is kind of at first, you know, breaking the stereotypes of what you might consider a chess player to be. I mean, I think in general, you know, that's kind of a great conversation to have, for kids to have, you know, to even watch the film, and for kids to be able to identify with the players in some different ways and identify with their struggles and their hopes and their dreams and their goals. So we really want the film to screen in schools eventually, and inspire kids to kind of think about their own goals and how they can achieve them, even if it seems like something that maybe is not the norm or not something that they've been told maybe that they're good at. And then, you know, on a much larger scale, I would love for this film to change the way people perceive after-school programs, you know, for people to start to not see them as extras anymore. And if we can make a difference in that way, you know, in some systematic way where, like, now schools can get more funding for after-school programs, you know, down the line, if we can make a bigger change in that way, you know, in Washington, you know, and bring this film and screen it on Capitol Hill and kind of be part of the conversation as lawmakers are talking about the fiscal cliff and talking about reauthorizing No Child Left Behind. And, you know, I mean, there's just so much debate around public education that it would be nice if after-school programs could be a part of that debate, and that, you know, a film like Broken Castle can help people see them in a different way.
Are you a chess player yourself?
No, I'm not. I mean, I can play now. I learned how to play by making the movie, but I still wouldn't call myself a chess player.
Yeah, it's something that I think is, how shall I say, very, very admirable. I played as a kid, and I realized it was over my head and stopped at a certain point, and it just makes one admire the kids in the film all the more.
Yeah, every now and then, you know, my husband and I will sit down and maybe try to start a game. But, I don't know, it hasn't stuck the way it has for the kids in the film. I think maybe I spend too much time shooting a movie about chess to actually become a chess player.
Katie Della Maggiore is director and producer of the documentary Brooklyn Castle. You can find out more about the film at brooklyncastle.com. And you can also go to it this weekend, starting Friday, at the CCA Cinematheque here in Santa Fe. For more information, ccasantafe.org. And you can call 505-982-1338. Katie, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
And we've got a few minutes left. I'd like to introduce Jason Silverman, or welcome back Jason Silverman. He's the director of the CCA Cinematheque, which is bringing Brooklyn Castle to Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So in addition to the screenings of this, what I think is a terrific movie, Brooklyn Castle, you have a chess tournament.
Yeah. Well, Mike, you know, Theo, my 10-year-old, plays chess. So I've watched all these kids kind of hunched over their boards with their with her brows furrowed, and I think this is good for the kids. You know, it's good. And when you see the film, you know how quickly chess can help you kind of grow and help you develop these skills that we could all use these days.
Yeah, like not being completely scattered and multitasking.
Exactly.
You cannot multitask and play chess, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, actually, you probably can. I mean, we did this tournament to encourage the kids to come out and play one day. But the format of the tournament is called a simultaneous tournament, which means often that you have a few great players playing a bunch of lesser players. In this case, we've got one fantastic player playing 30 kids all
at
once.
Oh, my goodness, here in Santa Fe.
Here in Santa Fe. So we're going to have a bunch of tables spread out at the CCA. Kids, from whatever age can come and sign up. They can sign up online. And they will play Patrick Cooper, who's a fantastic chess player.
Who's local.
Who's local. So he's going to come in and play them all, and the kid who can last the longest from each age group will be the winner.
So he's going to basically multitask because he's got a whole bunch of chess boards.
Yeah, 30 boards in his head at once.
And 30 kids.
30 kids, some of which are good.
Playing one dude. And so do you think, I mean, any chance any of them will beat him?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if they can, or but certainly having, you know, playing 30 at once is more of a challenge than playing one-on-one.
What's the chess scene like in Santa Fe?
There's chess clubs, there's school chess clubs, Waldorf has a club, there's a few others around town. Of course, you know, it would be great if it was stronger, but there's a few, supporters who are really active. Andy Nowak put this tournament together for us, and so there's people who are working on it. I think it's great for the kids.
So if... Is it already set, like the kids who are going to play, that's already set, or can kids still sign up?
Kids can still sign up, yeah.
How do they do that?
There's a website, and it's long, but if you Google...
You know what? I'll link to it on my website.
That's it, yeah. If you Google Child Chess Santa Fe, all one word, Child Chess Santa Fe.
Child Chess Santa Fe.
It'll come up. It's a Google site, and there's a registration form there.
Okay. And so that's happening. Young people can... play chess against a great master here in Santa Fe.
Exactly.
What else is
going on?
Not to be
intimidated. And we're going to show the film at 10 o'clock, free for any kids who participate, and then we're going to do the tournament.
Oh, okay.
And then we're going to do another screening afterwards, too. So the kids who are playing get to see the film for free, and they're going to come out all fired up to beat Coach Cooper.
Now, that is on Saturday, is the chess tournament this Saturday, December 15th, and the movie shows, Brooklyn Castle shows at 10, and then again at 10 in the morning, then again at 1 in the afternoon, and then again at 3:15. And if you want to go on Friday, it's at 2 and 4:15, and then you can figure out the other times by going to ccasantafe.org. But you're basically doing it kind of in daytime so that young people can go to the movie.
I've showed this to a few adults, including you, and we're all batty about it because it's such an insane, you know, it's like Rocky. So you can't believe these kids.
I know.
But we especially want kids to see it.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. There's all sorts of other stuff going on at
always,
the CCA.
Always.
So it's ccasantafe.org. Jason Silverman, director of the Cinematheque, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.